pussy sweeter than a sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll finish reading from Wish You Were Here, a collection of essays from the editor of Our State magazine, Elizabeth Hudson. To Everything a Season. On the first Friday night in October, the eve of the Ashboro Fall Festival, about a dozen men from the Randolph Cattlemen's Association hauled their blackened barbecue smokers up a grassy hill across from the courthouse and set them down in a single line. All the main streets downtown, Fayetteville, Sunset, Worth, were barricaded so that vendors could set up their booths in preparation for the thousands of people coming to the festival the next day. My grandmother lived right behind the courthouse. When I was a child, on the night before the fall festival, she and I would take a walk after supper and get our own behind-the-scenes glimpse at the preparations. We sneaked around, lifting up the capes covering booths with pottery and quilts, and peeking underneath. We got to see, before anyone else did, the needlework samplers and silk-screened T-shirts and string art and wooden toys handmade by local craftsmen. We watched the crews set up the stage for the gospel and country music groups that would play on the bank steps the next day. I'm sure we weren't supposed to be there, but no one ever noticed us, or, if they did, they turned a blind eye to the little girl holding the hand of her 70-year-old grandmother, and they let us have our evening. My favorite thing about the fall festival was getting a candy apple. It was a treat I couldn't get any other time of the year, an extra-large apple speared on a stick and coated with an inch of bright red hard candy shell. When my grandmother and I walked those streets at night, feeling the first chill of an early autumn evening on our arms, I'd think about how excited I was to come back the next day and buy my candy apple for 75 cents. It'd take about a half a day to finish it. Then, in the afternoon, I'd stand in line at the cattleman's tent for a barbecue sandwich, put together by those men who'd worked all night behind a long table, cutting and chopping meat with their cleavers, slinging mountains of pork into large aluminum casserole pans, getting it ready for the women to slap into buns, top with slaw and wrap in wax paper. Everything had its timetable. By about 8 p.m., as my grandmother and I were headed back home, we'd start to smell the barbecue from that hill, that perfect marriage of smoke and pork, the air singed with burning wood throwing bits of ash toward the sky. The smokers blazed red, and we'd hear the men on the hill laughing and talking. They'd stay there all night, tending to their meat and dozing in lawn chairs, waking early to spike it with vinegar and sauce and get it all chopped up and ready for Saturday's crowd. I loved the festival, but even more I loved the night before, when it was just the two of us, my grandmother and me, enjoying our own private prelude to fall. Back then it seemed like there'd be plenty more quiet autumn evenings to experience, plenty more brilliant blue autumn skies to enjoy the next day. I didn't realize then that it wouldn't be long before the leaves would start to turn and fall from the trees. It wouldn't be long before I wouldn't walk these streets with my grandmother anymore. It wouldn't be long before another season would come and go. At the time, I didn't think about those kinds of things. And if my grandmother did, she didn't let on. We lived in the moment, she and I. We walked home in the shadow of an autumn moon, shuffling amid the maples and birch leaves that had started to scatter on the sidewalk, watching a new season unfold right at our feet. Places like this. You know what kind of place this is. You can tell by the information rack in the doorway, bulging with real estate guidebooks and auto weekly newspapers. A metal "seat yourself" sign points you to the interior of the restaurant. A drape of fishnets hangs from the brown-paneled black wall. above a framed picture of a trawler. Over a row of booths, an old clock swings its pendulum, looking as if it's been in place for 30, 40, maybe 50 years or more. And behind the cash register, a new electric Pepsi clock marks time in shifts. Early lunch, lunch, late lunch, early dinner, dinner. There is no late dinner in places like this. Wall-mounted phones still ring. People call to place takeout orders or to check hours. Cashiers say, "We close at 10. In places like this, you can sit anywhere you like. A waitress wearing sneakers brings sweet tea to your table in 16-ounce styrofoam cups, lemon wedges partially submerged in the crunchy pellet ice. After she sets the drinks down, she tilts her hip upward to get to the straws tucked in her apron pocket, then fans them out like she's dealing cards. In tandem, everyone at the table reaches for a straw and taps it down to break its paper seal. You already know what you want in a place like this. The combination platter. Fried flounder and oysters, or calabash-style shrimp, hush puppies, and French fries. Sometimes you might substitute a baked potato, snow crab legs, scallops, a mound of coleslaw, and more tea, please. In places like this, waitresses raise trays high overhead and maneuver the dining room with a dancer's grace. They refill the industrial tea brewers, Louisiana 5-gallon barrels, constantly, and they shuffle pots on the 4-burner bun coffee maker like they're playing the shell game. Here go two with orange rims to denote decaf. Here go two with black rims to denote regular. They shovel ice from the 900-pound Scotsman cooler, a whale of an ice machine, into pitchers, and they pull plates of food from beneath the metal heat lamps in the kitchen. Everyone moves and dodges, bobs and weaves, swimming with the constant current of a busy eastern North Carolina seafood restaurant. In places like this, the men in the kitchen wear T-shirts and tans and full-body aprons that loop around their necks. Young men who come in to eat with their young families wear sunglasses on top of their heads. Old men come in with gold watches and hairy forearms and wedding bands that look as if they've been in place for 30, 40, maybe 50 years or more. And there's always a military guy. You can tell by his high and tight haircut and the respectful way he says, "Yes, ma'am," to the waitress when she asks if he needs more tea. He sits with his girlfriend or wife and child, and you remember that you're in a place within short driving distance of 8 significant military bases. You nod to him when you walk out. And when you walk out, you tug on your belt loop to pull your pants up a little, and your rare back, belly tight as a tick. In places like this, you always eat too much. You pay and amble back to the table, which has been cleared by now, and drop a stack of ones and a 5. It's a good tip. The food is only one reason we come to places like this. We come to these places, the Sanitary Fish Market in Moorhead City, Owens in Nag's Head, the Provision Company in Southport, Fisherman's Wharf in Wanchese, and hundreds more in between, because we know what we want, and we know what we're going to get. And when we come in straight off the beach, our skin still warm from the sun, our legs crusted with salt, we know we're welcome here. You know what kind of place this is. This is our kind of place. Flowers in the Sky. 10 years ago, when my dad retired, he went to Tractor Supply in Ashboro and Southside Hardware in High Point and bought the following. 1 dozen 55-gallon galvanized metal trash cans, 4 30-gallon galvanized metal trash cans, 2 18-gallon cans, and 2 oval wash tubs. After he hauled all these trash cans home, he drilled holes in the bottom of each one and set them in a 30-by-40-foot area to the side of the house. He filled each trash can with empty 2-liter ginger ale bottles to take up space and make the cans lighter and easier to move around. Then he poured in bags of potting soil. Not a lot, just enough dirt for roots to burrow. Then he added his plants. My dad who was never a gardener, planted morning glories and nasturtiums, sweet peas and bluebonnets. He planted herbs in the smaller cans, rosemary and basil and thyme for their green color. He planted vegetables, too, tomatoes and squash and eggplant and peppers. He planted sunflowers and trumpet vines in the waist-high cans, staking them so they towered high. And he planted moonflowers, their big, beautiful blooms coming out only at night. In the evening, after supper, my dad called to my mom to come out and see the moonflower, shimmering white against a black country sky. It was all a sight to see. People stopped on the back road behind my parents' house and walked down the hill into the yard to see what was growing. They were curious about these plants that popped up out of those metal trash cans, plants that grew 7 and 8 feet high. People in the grocery store stopped my parents and said, "Y'all are the ones who live in the house with the tin can garden." All those years in that house, and my parents never had a garden, not even a flower bed. For 30 years, they walked long hours running their business, leaving the house every day, even on the weekends, early in the morning, coming home well after dark. There was no time to put flowers in the ground. The earth around my parents' house was too poor, too full of rocks and red clay to properly dig up for a garden, and my dad, who was never a gardener, didn't have the right tools anyhow for preparing a traditional plot. So he improvised. He thought of something different. He wanted a garden. Instead of putting one in the ground, he put one in the sky. Larger than life. In 1982, the Tar Heels won the NCAA championship. I sat in the den with my dad and watched the game with him on a Magnavox television that weighed more than I did. I didn't know anything about basketball, except that all the players wore tiny shorts and tube socks that went up to their knees. It was a rare occasion when my dad had the night off from work, and the two of us sat on the couch together, watching players whose names I didn't know run back and forth. I tried to stay interested. Then, at the end of the game, Michael Jordan launched his winning shot. My dad, who's normally reserved, jumped up, a cigarette in the corner of his mouth, and started chanting the fight song, "Rah, rah, Carolina Lina." He grabbed me, and I jumped up too, both of us spinning around in the den, listening to the words, "North Carolina, North Carolina," come out of the TV, over and over. The next day, everyone at Farmer School, where I was in the 6th grade, went crazy. For some reason, back then, we all identified with one of two teams, State or Carolina. Probably not a one of us had ever been to Raleigh or Chapel Hill, and I know none of us had ever heard of, say, Wake Forest. But that didn't matter. All year long, we paraded down the halls in our Carolina blue ankle socks and our cherry red Wolfpack T-shirts, and we traced the school's logos on the fronts of our spiral notebooks. The day after Carolina won, the principal at Farmer School played the fight song, "Rah, rah, Carolina Lina," over the intercom. We cheered from our classroom seats. A few days later, Carolina Canners came out with grape-flavored Carolina Blue Soda. It was in a blue can, and the drink inside was blue, too. And everyone at my school, even the State fans, walked across the field to Farmer's store at lunchtime to buy one. For people like me, growing up in a rural county without a university, or even a big city nearby, that game catapulted basketball into something more than just basketball. It gave us something larger to connect to, something that went beyond the borders of our own county. As kids, we identified with larger-than-life symbols like basketball players who made memorable jump shots. Looking back, I realize we claimed our allegiance blindly. There was no particular reason for us, at age 12, to be State fans or Carolina fans, except that we watched our parents, who taught us how to be. My dad stood up and cheered for UNC's win that night because he went to school there. I remember the story he told me about hitchhiking from Ashboro to Chapel Hill. He didn't have a car, and he didn't have any other means of getting there. He went to UNC for 2 years and fell in love with it. Just before his 3rd year, he found out that my grandparents didn't have enough money to send him back. He had to quit and go to work. A half century has gone by since then, and I suppose he's let go of his disappointment of not being able to return to a place that meant so much to him. But I understand why he still pulls for a win every year. When we trace our beloved icons back to their origins, we realize it's not the places or the things themselves that are important. It's the memories they represent. As much as we love our lighthouses, our barbecue, our basketball, something else matters more. It's those summers spent in the shadow of Cape Hatteras, when both of our grandparents were still living. It's the chicken biscuit from Biscuitville on the way home after church, and the bottle of cheer wine opened at the end of a long day working outside. It's our mother's sweet voice singing softly to Doc Watson's Keep on the Sunny Side, when she thought no one was listening. And it's the basketball game that we watched for the first time with our dad, the one that made him, and us too, stand up and cheer. Where Hospitality Lives. My great-grandmother, Jessie Mabel Coble, granny to my mother, lived in a two-story wooden farmhouse out in the country in Julian. The siding on the house wasn't painted, and the front porch didn't have any underpinnings. Chickens ran around beneath the house. There was no heat except for a wood stove in the kitchen. Jessie Mabel's husband, Henry Pat, Papaw to my mother, got up at 3 a.m. every day to light the wood stove for heat, and so Granny could cook. There was no running water in the house, no indoor plumbing. They got their water from the well house and drank it, ice cold, right out of the dipper. A wash tub stayed outside, and they filled it for their baths in the evening. Jessie Mabel, Granny, was country. No one ever taught her proper manners or etiquette. She dipped snuff in the day and sat on the front porch of an evening with a broken-off hickory stick between her fingers, peeled back the bark, and cleaned her teeth. She sat like a man with her legs apart. She reached for things across the table. She never wrote a single thank-you note. But Jessie Mabel Coble set pitchers of tea for the 15 or so tobacco hands who came inside for lunch. And she kept food on the table all the time. Fried chicken, and bowls of cucumber and onions and vinegar, and pickled beets, and potatoes, and corn, and homemade biscuits. All this beneath a tablecloth to shield the food from flies. My mother loved it at Granny's house, a place with no running water and no heat, and where the food had to be covered up. Because for everything it didn't have, here's what it did have. It was warm. It was friendly. It was comfortable. In the mornings, Granny sat with my mother on the front porch, the two of them side by side in old cane-bottomed chairs. They shelled butter beans and churned buttermilk. She taught my mom how to pour butter into wooden butter molds and how to tap it out so that the pretty leaf pattern showed up on top. You wanted your butter to look nice, not for company, because company rarely came, but simply because it looked nice. In the evenings, Granny brushed my mother's hair, long, slow strokes, over and over, smoothing out her thick strands and checking for ticks. It felt good to have someone care about you like that, to have someone give you that kind of attention. When Hurricane Hazel hit in 1954, my mother was at Granny's house. They were terrified of the wind and the rain. They hid beneath a quilt on top of Granny's iron bed, and when they heard the hickory tree fall on the well house, they held on to each other, waiting for the storm to pass. Many years later, after I was born, my mother drove out to the country to pick up Granny and brought her home to stay at our house for a week. The two of them made a quilt, a grandma's flower garden pattern. My mother still has this quilt. It covers the iron bed, Granny's bed, in my parents' house. And you can tell whose stitches are whose. My mother's are precise and even. Granny's are longer and a little more ragged. Both are beautiful. Jessie Mabel Coble couldn't have told you what Southern hospitality is. She didn't know how to bring a covered dish to a church supper. In fact, she didn't even go to church, although she carried thankfulness in her heart. But she knew it was important to share her resources, as limited as they were, and she knew that it was important to give her time, her care, and, especially, her comfort to a little girl. Southern hospitality isn't always fancy. Sometimes it's unadorned. It doesn't always need white linens and porcelain teacups. It doesn't always remove its hat. It just needs a place where people, when they come there, feel at home. The Blessing of Memory. My cousin Steve called me the kid. I was 2 years old, and he was a teenager. And whenever we were in the same place, during holidays at my grandmother's house, Steve swaggered in, all high school cool, and grinned at my mom. "Where's the kid?" he asked every time. I don't remember Steve at all. I've seen pictures in old family photo albums, and he looked like the rest of the Hudson family. Jet black hair, a bright smile, mischievous eyes. I've seen pictures of him holding me, a young guy in bell-bottom jeans, his hair to his collar, swinging a happy little girl in the air. Steve died in a deer-hunting accident right around Thanksgiving, 40 years ago. It knocked my family down. That year, my parents had already bought Steve's Christmas present, a board game that they thought he'd love. It was already wrapped when everyone got the news. For years, I wondered how anyone was able to unwrap that present. I wondered how anyone was able to eat for months. I wondered how anyone was able to do anything at all. I don't remember Steve, but now, every year at Thanksgiving, when the weather turns cool and I can smell wood smoke drifting outside, I think about him. I think about being at my grandmother's house at later Thanksgivings, when Steve's mother, my Aunt Joan, told the story about how Steve played Oliver in a play at Trinity High School. At his funeral, someone sang a song from the show. For years, I wondered how she was able to tell this story without crying, but eventually she did. Somehow, people do. I think about being at my grandmother's house when, in the face of the worst thing that could happen to a parent, family gathered. I think about my grandmother's table, the one that held dinner when Steve died, the one that held dinner when my grandfather died, the one that held dinner when we all came year after year, cousins and aunts and uncles, and we squeezed together on couches and watched someone fiddle with the antenna on the television while we waited for the football game to come on. And then, sliding off the couch and sneaking into the kitchen, we lifted the tinfoil on the sheet pans set out on top of the stove, and we cut tiny squares of my grandmother's Thanksgiving dressing when nobody was looking, eating small pieces in secret, and cradling the crumbs in cupped hands beneath our mouths before we wiped our hands off on our pants legs and crawled back up on the couch, sliding in next to each other. Cousins and aunts and uncles. It takes a long time before sad memories give way to happier ones. But mercifully, thankfully, somehow this is exactly what happens. The other day I asked my dad to tell me about his nephew Steve, the one everyone called Stevie. "Oh," my dad said, "whenever he'd see you, his face would light up, and the first thing he'd say was, 'Where's the kid?'" I watched my dad as he smiled then and remembered. Listening, a Love Story. In the late 1960s, a woman named Susie, my mother before she was my mother, worked as a waitress at the Sheraton Hotel in Greensboro. She sparked with personality, and before long, the management promoted her to hostess of the fine dining restaurant. People came to eat on the nights she was working, and when her regular customers came in the door, she grabbed menus and escorted couples to their special tables. Not long into her job as hostess, the management moved her again, this time to behind the bar of the Matador Room. One evening, a man named Phil, my dad before he was my dad, came into the restaurant, sat at the bar, and ordered a Schlitz on draft. My mother poured the drink and thought he was the best-looking man she'd ever seen. He had wavy black hair and a brilliant smile, and she thought he looked just like Joe Namath. The man, who was my dad before he was my dad, drank his beer, left his money under his glass, and left the bar without saying anything. The woman thought she'd never see him again. But the next night, he came back. He waited for the woman who wore her dark hair in a beehive and talked like Loretta Lynn to finish her shift, and he took her out for a late-night dinner. They stayed out for a long time, talking about everything, their work, their days, their life, their pasts, and their futures, until the restaurant finally locked the doors and turned out the lights and told them to go home. My parents, before they were my parents, sat in my dad's car, talking and finding their voices deep into the night. You wonder what keeps a couple together for 40, 50, 60 years. You wonder what's the secret to a long and interesting marriage. Once I came across my parents' wedding photo, a single-color print. They keep it in a photo box on a shelf, not even in a frame. In it, my mom is wearing a long blue satin dress and white gloves. My dad is in a sharp black suit. They're posed in front of a brown-paneled wall at the courthouse. They look happy. But they also look quiet. It doesn't seem right. That's the thing you notice when you stare at pictures long enough. They capture everything but sound. When I think of my parents, I think first of their voices, the constants that haven't changed despite age and illness and surgeries and time. My dad's hair isn't black anymore. My mother doesn't wear a beehive. But their voices are the same, as strong and distinct as when I was young and would listen to them talk at night. When I was a child, long after I should have been asleep, I remember lying in bed, overhearing my parents' late-night conversations. They worked long hours back then and got home well after supper time. They had a business to run and daily things to take care of. Every decision they made was through careful conversation with each other, always with each other. Every night, I listened to the scrape of their forks on plates while they ate their late-night dinner, and I heard them talking. For hours at the kitchen table, they talked. About what, I don't know. Their pasts and their futures, maybe? Their work, their days, their life. Sometimes they raised their voices. Sometimes they argued. But mostly, I heard my dad's hearty laughter and my mom's sweet accent sounding just like a country singer. And I listened as their voices drifted up the stairs in the night, finding their way toward me, filling in the darkness. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.